right. Good morning, everyone. Can I have your attention, please? Good morning. Well, I heard there was some serious partying going on last night, so your presence this morning is really appreciated. Who really partied hard last night? Come on. Not too many hands. So that's why you're here this morning. Okay, now I get it. Since we're on the subject of partying, this session, this event is being live webcast, so please behave yourselves. I would like to welcome you all. My name is Dimitrios Vakratsis. I'm Associate Dean Master's Programs here at the Desotel Faculty of Management. And I will be your host for the show today. What is the show? What is in store today is we have two plenary sessions. One this morning in a few minutes, depending on how long I'm going to talk, and then one that comes and wraps it up in the afternoon. In between, on either side of lunch, we're going to have four parallel sessions. So the four parallel sessions are going to be after this panel presentation, and they're going to repeat on the other side of lunch. And, of course, at lunch, we're going to have some pretty good entertainment here from Sugar Sammy. Are we ready for it? Okay. Let's go. Let's do it. Well, now the MBA 50 is a great opportunity to look back and celebrate the achievements of the MBA program over this last 50 years and all the accomplishments, all thanks to you, the alumni. So thank you very much. And there's going to be some of that looking back, I hear, at the gala. So please don't miss it. The theme for the day, which is a little bit more serious, so we're going to take ourselves off the party mood a little bit. The theme for today is actually looking forward, looking ahead. It's about the future. And the future of management, of course. The future is always an exciting topic. It's always great to talk about the future, but it's also scary. And it's scary because there's a lot of uncertainty about it, right? And there's a few ways to go about resolving this uncertainty. One is a good old trick, like this magic ball that I have here. I call it magic ball. It's a fake crystal ball, actually, right? And that can help you ask questions about the future. So one question that I worry about all the time is, will we get more MBA applications next year, right? That's a big, worrisome question. By the way, I would like to welcome our prospective MBA students. We have some here in this room, and we hope that you'll join us pretty soon. Your businesses appreciate it. So how many MBA applications am I going to get next year? The only thing I have to do is shake this magic ball, okay, turn it over, go to Lily, and so she can give me my answer. Lily, will we get more MBA applications next year? No. What does it say? No doubt about it. Thank you very much. Okay? But the idea today in the session is a little bit different, right? We can do a little bit better than the magic ball. Another way to approach the future and the uncertainty about the future is the way that Abraham Lincoln suggested, who said that the best way to predict the future is to create your own. And over this past 50 years, we've seen, nurtured, and developed a lot of talent, you, that can not only shape their own future, right, but they can shape the future of a lot of many people that they influence. And the idea today is that we invite some of the homegrown talent, and we discuss about topics on the future of management, and then we open up the discussion to the rest of us. So does this sound like a plan? All right, fantastic. And now I think we're sufficiently warmed up. We're fully awake, hopefully. Right, and we need the warming up because it's chilly out there. And we're ready for the first panel discussion. And the topic is, appropriately, our future, convergence or collision course. So with that, I would like to present and introduce our first panelist, Bertrand Cesvert, MBA 88 from the great class of 88. Yes. There's a long list of accomplishments here. Bertrand is the executive chairman and also the head strategist for the agency and senior partner of Sid Lee. He is in charge of the international operations. I literally live across the street from Sid Lee. I've never seen him in the neighborhood, contrary to his claims. I see him at the airport and on the plane all the time. Yes, he's very busy internationally, but as a head strategist, also he's responsible for bringing a lot of clients like Dell, Volkswagen, Adidas, Cirque du Soleil, of course, Red Bull, Dom Perignon, Carlsberg Beer, lots of drinks brands. I like that. He also sits on the board of OneDrop, that is a foundation that makes sure that everybody on the planet has access to clean water. He's also the co-author of a very successful and best-selling business book, Conversation Capital, How to Create Stuff People Love to Talk About. So please join me in welcoming Bertrand Cesbé. Our next panelist is Inez Jabalpurwala, MBA 2000, or as I like to call it, MBA 00. Right? It's got an Asian feel to it. It's got an Asian sound to it. Inez presently is the president and CEO of Brain Canada Foundation, which supports research, brain research, and it's a national non-for-profit organization. Previously, she was the executive director of the Graham Beck Foundation, which is a private family foundation that supports initiatives and programs about mental health issues. She was also senior investment analyst with Beck Investment. She has a lot of other activities. She currently sits on the board of Equitas, which is an international center for human rights education. She is also, let me hold my breath here, on the board of the McGill University Alumni Association, serving as a treasurer and member of the executive and nominating and governance committees. So she's a very busy woman. And, of course, not surprisingly, in 2007, she was named as one of Canada's top 100 most powerful women by the Women's Executive Network. So please join me in welcoming Inez. Our third panelist is Hubert Lacroix, who is chairman and president of CEO president and CEO of CBC Radio Canada. He is responsible, of course, for managing CBC and also making sure that we get, as Canadians, high-quality programming from broad spectrum from our national public broadcaster. He had a long, successful career in the legal field as well. Previously, he was a senior advisor with the Montreal office of the law firm Stackman Elliott. Prior to this, he acted as executive chairman of Telemedia Corporation. Before that, for 20 years, was senior partner at McCarthy & Tétrault, another law firm. Please join me in welcoming Hubert. Our last but not least, our very own. Well, everybody's our very own here, okay? Julie Saveria. She is just about still an MBA student. She's graduating on Thursday.
Yes.
Right?
Thank you.
I think I've signed that letter, so, you know, we're in the clear. Julie, before joining the MBA program, she worked as a clinical research coordinator at St. Justine Hospital and the MUHC. She did a very interesting internship last year at South Africa for Mzingo Group, working with a network, a community-based organization that helps children that are affected by HIV/AIDS. And she is looking, she's aspiring towards a career in that general field of not-for-profit consulting, social innovation, and international development. So please, let's put our hands together for our moderator today, Julie Saveria. And I'll leave you to that, and I'll leave you in the safe and capable hands of Julie. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Demetrios. So basically, as most of us here in this room, our panelists graduated with an MBA from McGill University. And we would like to know, how do you think that it contributed to your actual success? And if so, what did it teach you and how did it really help you get to where you are today? So I can start with Bertrand.
For me, it was, of course, I learned a lot of skills that are important in business. obviously, you know, it's a business literacy degree. But the other thing that they taught me, for me, it was always the, you know, today I have a fairly international career, but it really started here, you know, being from Montreal. When I was in the MBA program, I had, you know, the program already back then was very international. And it created, I think, for me, it shifted my ambitions and shifted my perspective about, you know, what should be my playground around the world. So it was very, very important.
And for me, an MBA brought two things. It gave me a toolkit to be able to execute a vision. And it also showed me the importance and the value of collaboration. And I think in terms of a toolkit, you know, an MBA is not a substitute for vision or for drive. But as Thomas Edison famously said, vision without execution is hallucination. And so I think that what you need to always be looking at as a leader, as a manager, as an entrepreneur, is that you have a vision, but then you need to put together the systems and the processes to really execute that, to keep focused on the end goal, but at the same time to get all those details right. And that's where you need to have the toolkit. And in terms of collaboration, I look at the model with the MBA, and of course, 15 years ago, I can remember vividly all of those team projects, which at the time seemed quite agonizing. But they really fostered in me an appreciation for the power of collaboration, for diversity in terms of thinking and approaches, and also to look at being challenged and why that was so important to getting better outcomes. Brain Canada is very much built around that vision, a group of really different players, business leaders, scientists, academics, came together to create the largest fund in Canadian history for brain research. And we really did it by embracing that way of sort of connecting different people together in unexpected ways. And I think, you know, to Bertrand's book around conversations, you know, for me it's always been, how do you figure out who needs to be connected? What are the conversations that you need to be having? And what are the questions that you should be asking? And that's really what drives any kind of innovation, and it's certainly been the hallmark of Brain Canada.
Thank you.
When I think about my MBA at McGill, three things come to mind. The explosion of the subject matters that all of a sudden I was exposed to. I came from law. I was a kid, much too young, graduated much too young from law school, wasn't ready for the world, started to work, and then came into McGill's MBA program where instead of being subject matter expertise, it was about all sorts of things in trying to get to a conclusion. It was about the whole problem. It wasn't about a particular piece of the problem. So that was a very important aha moment for me. The second thing was, and it's interesting that you mentioned that, it was teams. All of my life, or most of my life, has been extremely impacted by sports. And in that environment, and my expertise was basketball, we focused on, we practiced, we recruited, we put together teams, and we had goals. All of a sudden, instead of being on your own, which was, I mean, I'm not knocking down law, but lies about trying to do some stuff together. I mean, yeah, we had study groups, but nothing of the kind of work projects that this MBA program did. And you got, we had 16 countries, to Bertrand's point, in our MBA. I will always remember this. 16 countries represented on 70 students, or just about. So instead of being all kids from CGEP or for first and second year law schools, we had, all of a sudden, the world around us. And we were put in teams with people of different skills, of different personalities, in trying to drive towards a goal. Now, that is what I do every day. The third thing was the people. And I bumped into Morty as I walked in, Morty Yalofsky, and I told him that I was going to talk about him because he's on the paper right here. The teachers and the students in the room. Two professors I will always remember in my life. Morty and a guy by the name of, I think it was Robert Fowler. It was Professor Fowler, a finance guy. I'm a lawyer. No background whatsoever walking in with respect to stats or finance or the math that I needed to support this base of knowledge I had needed to acquire. If it wasn't for the patience of these teachers, and boy, did I bug Morty, and I was in his room all the time. So that creates now a focus on people. because we can be the best with the widgets that we have, and we can be extremely good with spreadsheets and numbers. But if you don't care about the people around you, and 50 or 60% of my job is about people, sometimes I screw up badly with those relationships. But those relationships and the care that Morty and Fowler had in me and the belief that I could actually do this was what changed my life.
Well, thank you very much for your insights. And next, well, that's pretty clearly important to me since I'm about to graduate. But what do MBA graduates today absolutely need to get out of an MBA program in order to succeed as managers, entrepreneurs, and to lead organizations in the future? I know you all touched upon this a little bit, but I'd like to get it in it a little bit more.
Well, to me, I think that there are, you know, what's really impressive right now is how quickly the world changes. I mean, and it's actually quite scary. But to me, I think that there are two skill sets now that are more important than ever. And one is adaptability. So your old relationship as a person to change is very, very important. And the other pillar for me is collaboration. You talked about it, but the problems are getting so complex to solve. At the end of the day, I know very few brains that can solve everything, you know, all these problems. So people now have to learn to work together, to collaborate together, and get onto, I think that the soft skills are still very important. In my organization, I always say that, you know, collaboration is based on three pillars. There are two that are very obvious. The first one is intent, trying to do the right thing. Everybody gets around that. And then there's a debate. If you're trying to solve a problem, it's about being right. And again, everybody understands that. But the third force is basically the force of harmony and consensus. And, you know, the true leader is somebody who can harness all three and can really establish direction, identify the proper problem to solve, get to the right solution, and then, you know, socialize it and make sure that it becomes everybody's solution. So to me, I think that these are, you know, the very, very important thing that are necessary to succeed and thrive in the future.
And I think, you know, to touch on what Bertrand has said around the complexity of some of the challenges today, you have to embrace a mindset that really is about bringing together different sectors, people from different industries, people from unexpected areas. You know, if Estelle Mettaillé were here, she would talk about how to avoid blind spots. And one of her core principles on that is that you should not surround yourself with people who have exactly the same output and the outreach and approach. You have to try to bring in people who come from completely different areas that can be disruptive. And it's hard to do because we tend to be comfortable around people that are sort of like us. And I remember when I did my MBA in the group projects, the teams would want to do that. And so, you know, everybody that was in a certain area would want to cluster together. And we would have professors who I'm so grateful to this day who would say, no, I actually want you to go and work with this group that has an engineer and that has someone else. And it was important to do that. And I think if you can take that through your career and be able to bring consensus around disparate people, you can truly be a leader and rise, because that really is the big challenge of leaders who are able to deal with that kind of diversity and still manage to have a common purpose and a shared set of goals and be able to achieve that.
I'm there too. I mean, my business, what we do every day, it's about change. I'm sure you realize that in 2010 at the Vancouver Olympics, the iPad did not exist. That's 2010. It's not like 2010. Uncertainty, the ability to deal with change, the ability to deal with uncertainty. Unfortunately, I was raised by nuns and Jesuits. I believe in black and white. Everything we did was black and white, right? This is the influence of those upbringings. Now, having worked at CBC Radio-Canada for the last 8 years, my favorite color is gray. And you have to be able to live with that uncertainty every day. Change, absolutely. The fact that you want people with different ways of looking at a problem, yes. But for me, it's all about being able to live in an environment where you will be always confronted with change. There is no such thing as a place where you get comfortable.
The one thing I would add as well is I think that quantitative skills are fundamental. You can't run away from quantitative skills. I think that in my generation, I think it was possible to assume, to say, you know what, I'm not that quantitative, so I'm not going to work in finance, I'm going to work in marketing. Or I think that we're entering an era where and it's a big challenge for schools, and it's a big challenge, in my opinion, for our education system. If you take somebody, you know, like the thinking that we have that, you know, a liberal arts, you know, education is a great foundation because it allows you to communicate and all of that. I think that, yeah, that's a start, but now in addition to being able to develop a worldview, and acquiring, like in an MBA program, business literacy skills, I think that the data also is unavoidable, and a really, really good grasp of what's going on at a quantitative level is unavoidable.
Can I add to that one second? We're going to talk about integrated management. Mm-hmm. I talk about integrating all of these skills, financial literacy, absolutely. An understanding that the person who has people and culture, let's say the HR portfolio, when she sits or he sits at the table with the senior executive team, she or he is expected to have the knowledge of the business that does not only talk about or focus on the HR piece. I want a contribution for this person on the overall issue that's at the table. And if you're not ready to have this conversation, or you don't have the tools, as Bertrand says, to actually participate in the conversation, you're not going to survive. It's going to take, you're going to be spitted out by not only, the team is going to realize that all of a sudden we have a person that can't contribute to the conversations from a consolidated or an overall point of view and only is a subject matter expert. And if you do that, you will become a subject matter expert.
And I would add one last thing to, because I absolutely agree, the qualitative skills are essential. But, you know, I have to say the one area that I always felt was undervalued when I did my MBA was HR. And it was sort of you take one course and there's a textbook that tells you if you do X, Y, Z, you'll get the following outcomes because people behave if you motivate them in certain ways. And when you start a career and you're leading people and managing people, you realize it's actually not that simple. And I have the hugest admiration for people who are experts in HR, in managing people, and actually understanding how to do that well. It's a serious endeavor when you're actually leading people, and it's irresponsible if you are careless about how you manage a team. But likewise, you'll deal with a lot of complex situations with people that will take up a lot of your time. I talk to many other of my colleagues in other sectors across the board, and they always say, oh, God, that's the hardest thing. You know, HR, finding the right person. You hire one person, then someone else leaves, and you're always filling holes. Getting the right team together, it's an art. And so I would caution, don't undervalue. That is a really critical area, and I think MBAs should spend even more time on HR. And we're very lucky at Brain Canada. We have Lily de Grandpre on our board, and she has absolutely taught me certainly a great deal about the importance and value of HR.
One other class that if I could go back to MBA school and redo, was OB, Organizational Behavior. Yeah. I thought that was a basket weaving class. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was the easiest class on the schedule. And, you know, you came in there and you were actually, good.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You're feeling no.
But understanding the behavior of the organization, the culture of the organization, linking the people to the product or to the outcome, understanding what makes the organization tick, the culture shifts, how to do it. I mean, at CBC Radio-Canada, we're trying to go from a television-driven enterprise to one which is going to lead with whatever widget you have in your pocket. Wow. I wish I would have been a better student in that class.
Well said. So now, our very own Desautels has been a first mover and leader in novel forms of integrated research and teaching. And nowadays, a lot of business schools, including ours, of course, are branding themselves with concepts like integrated curriculum, integrated management, and integrative thinking. So just to touch base, the idea is that business schools, as Ines mentioned, business schools need to help the managers to think and manage in a more integrative fashion and to also consider all aspects of a business before making or when making an important decision, and that includes environmental and societal implications. Now, I would like to know, so we're going to start with Bertrand. Do you value and or apply this approach at Sidley?
Well, obviously, I mean, I think that, you know, when I started in this business, it was like Mad Men, right? It was an art director staring at the souls of a copywriter and, you know, trying to draft up story while drinking scotch. I mean, that was all true. Now the problems we have to solve, I have to bring to bear, you know, data modelers, industrial designers, architects, creative technologists, things that I did not even know existed. So for us, yes, absolutely, the notion of integration is absolutely critical. What we do in my business is we create brand environments that are, you know, as a consumer, you don't go like, oh, I'm watching my phone, and, you know, and then you walk into a store and say like, oh, it should be very different. You know, like people, we just move, you know, through life. So integration is very important. And I've experimented a lot with it. I mean, at the beginning it was just like, yeah, let's get a bunch of people together and it's going to be cool, right? And but it's quite hard. It's quite hard because the standards are very, very difficult to measure, you know. Like today, for instance, I go back to this data piece, which is becoming incredibly important in my business. You know, I can see the portfolio of an art director, but, you know, a great data modeler, I mean, I don't know what it looks like. You know, like a great iOS programmer, I mean, I don't code, so I don't know. So, what's really, really difficult is just that your brain, you're not capable, even though you understand you need all these things, you have a sense of how you're going to pull them together and that you can pull them together. And the quick answer could be, like, culture is good way of doing it, identifying the problem, you know, up front, you know, is a part of the problem. But it's very hard. It's extremely hard to get all these people to work together. And I think that it's great that McGill is tackling that problem, because I think that this is going to be one of the great, great, great challenges of the future is how to do this. And I don't think we're nearly as advanced on that. We know we need it, we try it, we get people together, but how it really works is still remains unknown.
Ask him a question.
Yes, of course.
I'm a great fan of his business. He doesn't know it. because
I'm a fan of the CBC too.
What I struggle with a lot is this data piece and the people who are responsible for that, and the artsy guys and women who think that the last thing they want
is data.
Is data. So how are you handling that challenge as you just blow everybody's minds with these concepts that you go through? How are you handling that?
Well, I think that, you know, right now, you know, the data problem is, at the beginning, I think that it's fairly easy for everyone to understand that data is useful for measurement. That's fine, you know, and establishing KPIs and all of that is a start. Now I think that what's really, really important is using data as an input to a creative process. And data as an input to a creative process is, there's a language. I think that there is almost like you go from data to synthesizing the data, and then you have to develop tools to express the data so that creative people get it. So a lot of effort has to do with how you repackage that data and how, you know, you use it as an input. But, you know, at the end of the day, you have no choice. The other thing is it's a matter of survival. It's not even, if you don't do that, you're done. I mean, you know, like there's the whole pressure of embracing this and very, very fast, because you could lose everything.
And there's, I mean, in science, the big trend now is big data. Mm-hmm. The fact that the cost of mapping a genome has come down to the level where we can collect now these large samples of patient data on any disease or any propensity to a disease. And now it's about this intersection between brain science and technology, where you're building all these platforms to house all this data. and trying to figure out how do we standardize this data so that then it can be accessible to the largest number of people, and then how do we interpret that data? Now, the huge value is the fact that you suddenly get people looking at data who would not have had access before. So if you didn't deal with a patient cohort in a particular disease, you couldn't do research on that. Now, somebody who wants to do Alzheimer's research can access a huge database of every sample of, 3,000 samples. That's very powerful, but it is the challenge in science. We haven't quite figured out how to get it right, and there are a lot of issues, of course, tied to that. And notwithstanding to incentivize pharma and biotech to invest when suddenly everything is available now in open platforms, and we're moving towards not having anything that's proprietary because it advances the science, including mistakes that are made that don't get published that we'd like to be able to make available because that's how you...
But that's an IP issue, right?
Yes.
That's back to your old career.
Exactly.
At the end of the day, I think that one of the things we need in Canada or as the world changes is we need to reconsider how we will view IP, intellectual
exactly.
property, moving forward.
Yeah. Ibel, did you have anything to add?
Well, integrated management, we come from a land where for close to 80 years, our organization was built on silos. radio, then television, then the web, then les Anglais, les Français. Not that they didn't speak to each other, they just didn't work together. And we lost all of this expertise. So as resources diminish and the political environment gets more complicated, you don't have a choice. The actual output and the result of it is where we should have been a long time ago. So now we've integrated the teams. There is no, and because, let's say, a few years ago you had the digital team and then radio and television, now they're fully embedded, they work together, there's a combination of skills there, because from a lab environment, which was the digital / web environment, now it's no longer that, it's a way of life, it's a world, it's not a platform. I mean, your widget's not a platform, it's a world. And the kids that are coming behind us are actually using it. I mean, there's no such thing as being offline. When they're offline, they sleep. They're online all the time. So we have to change our mindset with respect to the widget. It's not a platform.
Very true. And a follow-up question, what do you see as the most divergent or disparate perspectives in your business which could really benefit from a more integrated solutions, for example, at Sidley?
Let me just process this. I'm not sure I understand the question. More, what do you mean by divergence? I'm not sure I understood the question.
Like, so what side of your business do you see as being in real need of a more integrated approach?
Production. I think that, it's a big thing. I think that, one of the big... the reality today now is that because of technology, there's a new vector in what we do. And that vector that exists is time. I don't think that as business people we have a terribly good relationship to time. We do a business plan, we look at it. It's a series of PowerPoint. We put it on the shelf. But as soon as you do that, that business plan has disappeared. But in my business, what's really important is at the end of the day, there can be a lot of thinking. There can be a lot of strategizing and all of that. But you need to deliver on an ongoing basis. So in my business, what's important is increasingly my business has to look like a newsroom. It cannot be something, business where, and, I have an ex-colleague of mine here, but it's just speed and our whole relationship to time and therefore production in advertising. For instance, I could never understand why you can do 1 hour of TV for $100,000 and I can only shoot a 30-second commercial for $500,000. I did not, for me, that, I'm happy I made money with it, a fair bit amount of it. But at the end of the day, it makes no sense. At the end of the day, and why 30 seconds is $500,000 and half an hour is 100,000 is because there is so much, like, brands want to control the message. There's so much stuff in crafting and all that. It's over. We have to just see a problem and produce and move on and rinse and repeat. And so it's a big, big, big acceleration of this whole, in a management process, thinking, you know, pondering politics, deciding. I mean, it doesn't work this way. If you're running the New York Times today and you stop, you know, you think 2 days, you know, what should we do about Clinton's Benghazi emails? Let's reflect on that. You know, like, it's yesterday's news. I mean, you know, like, so I think that time is a very important variable.
Brain Canada was built on this premise that if you want to advance research, you have to do more than just raise a lot of money. You have to change the way we're doing research. And so for us early on, it was really always about how do you connect the right people, organizations, and resources with a common purpose and a common vision. And we call it a systems approach. So our tagline is one brain, one community. And it's very much about this notion that you need to build a community to address challenges of the brain. So it's scientists and clinicians and patients, families, caregivers, advocates, it's business leaders, philanthropists, governments, other voluntary organizations in other spaces even, all of them working together to get from an idea to an outcome that is then translated to something that delivers to people. That is no longer the notion of progress and advances in a linear model. It's all about creating an ecosystem. So when we think about Brain Canada's power in this space, we always think that what we've been able to do is create an ecosystem where it's not about the silo of neuroscience anymore. It's about brain research and how do we get engineers and physicists and ethicists, biologists, how do we get all of these people working together with a common set of goals and common purpose. And I think that's really the challenge. If you do that well, and it's not an easy task, but if you do that well, I think that's where you can really enable the big paradigm changes that are going to advance any field, not just science, but any field today.
And what do you do with the speed thing? Because I understand stakeholders. Got them all over. Tell me about can you do what you just did, what you just described. He does this, he decides in his boardroom. Yep. Okay, the shareholders are there, the decision makers are there. How do you actually speed it up?
So that's where the money is important. So we design grants where we say we'll provide you with $1.5 million over 3 years, but come up with a great idea and bring together everybody that you think needs to be involved in advancing this idea. And we will only fund you if we see something that is truly going to change paradigms. And that amazingly gets attention. And so what we found is we're currently funding 77 such projects. But we piloted this early on with 5. They've been transformative. And let me give you an example of what we've been able to do. So we have Frieda Miller, who is the person who discovered how you can take harvest stem cells from skin. She's in Toronto. You have Sam Weiss, who's in Calgary. He is the person who discovered how you can take these skin cells that are stem cells that now turn into brain cells. And then you have Wolfram Tetzlaff, who holds the Rick Hansen Chair in British Columbia, and he is a person who knows how to repair spinal cord using stem cells, but he needs to get hold of them. The three of them hear about this grant opportunity, and they say, you know what, we each run big labs, we could continue to do our same labs, but maybe if we get together, we can get these dollars and really advance. And so what they've been able to do now is to develop a whole process where they came together virtually, but they physically flew those cells to Wolfram, where he transplanted them. And they were able to show that there could be some improvements. And it goes even further than that, because white matter, which is what is being repaired in the spinal cord, is also implicated in multiple sclerosis and in schizophrenia. So now you have a model where you're not only connecting people that wouldn't have worked together around a common purpose of an objective, but you're having a benefit that is much broadly to the whole community, and hence this idea of the brain as one system, where any discovery you make can actually be applied to multiple conditions. So there is a speed, and we run this like a business. There are milestones and deliverables on an annual basis, and that's how you get science to move forward. It's not just a lot of great creative ideas. It's about discipline, putting discipline to ideas to get to outcomes.
Integrated teams. That was, I think, our integrated management. That's where we started from. I'll give you two little quick pictures of how our environments change. I'll talk about Sochi. We were pretty good with the Sochi Games and our coverage of it. You could actually not open your television set and watch it on your widget of choice, your iPad. I actually challenged my team with that, and it worked because I watched the first week of the Olympic Games and literally never opened my television set and was fully informed. But Sochi was interesting because we challenged ourselves because, again, funding restrictions, but also because we asked ourselves, why is it costing us so much with so many people going to, with the old model? And the old model is you send your crew over there, you build your studio, and you actually produce the show in that city, the city of the Olympics. And we said, do we actually need this? Could we do it differently? Could we actually produce the show in Montreal or in Toronto, depending whether it's Radio-Canada or CTV, or Radio-Canada or CBC, and challenge, and challenge CTV's model, which is, and NBC's model, which is sending thousands of people on location. Not only did we do that well, we sent 220-some people in Sochi. NBC sent 2,500 people in on the ground in the BBC, and you know how good the Brits are for Winter Games, right? The Brits sent 150 people for about 12 hours of live programming during the week. NBC was so overwhelmed and so amazed by the model that we built, which was some people actually on the ground in Sochi, but the whole of the production team staying behind, that they actually now looking at us, and we're going to be broadcasting the Pan Am Games this summer out of Toronto with the model that we built. But that's CBC and Radio-Canada working together and challenging the models of the people behind and putting everybody in the same room. We did this too in Halifax. We were in two buildings, seven different floors. Great collaboration between the teams. So we decided that we needed to put everybody in the same spot. The buildings were crumbling in any event. We went from 145,000 square feet to 43,000 square feet. That's the easy part. The tough part was completely open air concepts. There is not a single office for an executive in our new facilities in Halifax that are opening on June 10th. That's the model by which we work. You know, I'm sure that you have encountered these kinds of environments, but that's a big shift. Again, resources being pooled, being able to work in the right-hand side of the building on the Monday because your team's over there, and then working on another program somewhere else, reducing costs. That's about turning around quickly. But again, the mind shift behind, we're all in our offices, and as you go above, and I remember a guy coming to me and saying, Lacroix, I've been working here for 20 years. Now you're taking me out of the office that I've been working for how many years? Yeah, and the answer is yes. There is no such thing as offices. And if I could, we would do this across our country in all the locations we have much faster to do exactly what you're doing in bringing people together in the same spot.
Perfect. So we're just going to ask you one last question before going to our conclusion. So I'm going to ask Hubert. There has been a lot of debate on gender equality and the lack of female presence in the C-suite and on multiple boards. And I would like to know, do you believe that there is still a glass ceiling for women, and will it continue? Will it still be an issue in about 10 years?
I feel very strongly and very passionately about this subject matter. I sat on a committee that the government of Quebec put together, 10 people, trying to force some direction on public companies with quotas of women on boards. I don't believe in quotas on women on board at all. What I do believe, though, is you need to put the best possible people in management positions, in spectacular management positions, because when you have women in those positions, there's where they're going to shine, and that's how they are going to be able to move this concept that, to break the famous old boys club concept. But quotas, I don't believe in. In our environment at CBC Radio-Canada, 48% of our staff are women. On my senior executive team. When I walked in 8 years ago, I was the youngest person in the room, if you can believe this. And there were 11, I had 11 direct reports, one woman, 10 men, everybody looked like me.
8 years later, I have 7 direct reports, 8 with chief of staff, so 8 women, eight people in the room. I have 5 women, 3 men. I'm not saying that we are better than anybody else. We just pick the best possible people. And because of the schools and because of the system, you have now this incredible opportunity to put and to help the positions that we have around us and nurture great female executives in a smart way. And I'll just finish. I don't think it's about, I think diversity right now is much more than simple looking at gender balance. You go to Vancouver. If you don't understand the community in Vancouver, or you go to Winnipeg, you don't realize that the community has changed completely there. Or you go to Edmonton. I'm into Edmonton. I'm into my station. We do a group of stakeholders. We chat with them. 60% of the room was black, but not black from Canada, black from Africa, because in that part of our country right now, they're mining, and they're doing great stuff with, well, they're doing oil. Related ventures. And you know who the best miners in the world are? The Africans, because they've been doing that in their country for a very, very long time. So the smart Canadian companies are going over there and getting the best executives and the best workers, and all of a sudden the face of Edmonton is changing. If we, as the public broadcaster, if we don't recognize that and we don't reach out in that community and we don't reflect in our programming in Edmonton what the community is all about, we're going to be completely disconnected, and it's not going to work. So it means your faces in front of the camera, the voices behind the microphones, the people on your staff, the people that actually have to relate to the community, because that's our job. We are the leaders in promoting culture. We promote democracy. So that link to the community is absolutely key.
Do you have anything to add?
I think that Canada in general is not doing terribly well at gender or racial diversity. I don't think we're, compared to the U.S., you know, when you walk into a boardroom and you look at the C-suite of U.S. companies, I think that Canada does not, is actually very terrible. I will only talk about what I know, and my business is an entrepreneurial business. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's never discussed is I was capable to start my business because my wife was a lot smarter than me, and she made a lot more money than I did, and I was comfortable with taking that entrepreneurial risk, or I was stupid enough to do it and manage a level of success. I don't think there should be a conversation. I find that women and men are equally as smart, equally as capable of starting businesses at being entrepreneurs. But I don't think that this is something that we hear a lot about. There are very few men that I know that would go, you know, I'm going to support, you know, take care of kids and support your entrepreneurial journey, my love. This is something that needs to be put on the agenda. So if I look at my organization, we're really, really overdeveloped in, you know, there's a lot more guys than girls, and the reason is very simple. I mean, it was born of an entrepreneurial journey, and there were not a lot of women that were willing, they wanted to take that challenge, but, you know, they were not capable of taking that challenge for obvious reasons. And that is something that we have to address.
And I think, you know, you cannot deny the reality that women are underrepresented on boards and in senior leadership positions. That's a fact. And there are many strong voices that are advocating for having quotas on boards. And part of the value, and I think Monique Jérôme-Forger is one of them, and she always says, you know, when I was appointed to boards at times I would be the token female, but then I would do such a good job, and that's the only way you start to change thinking, that if you get them in the door and get them on the boards, then people start to realize the immense value that diversity of thinking brings. And sometimes it doesn't happen naturally, and that is why there is this argument to be made for imposing quotas. I think science has always attracted me because I saw it as this great equalizer where it's really a big talent search. And it doesn't really matter your gender, your ethnicity, your country of origin, or even if you speak the same language in a lab. Labs are incredible international places. You know, it's one of the most exciting parts of my job is visiting labs and seeing this. And they all come together because it's this great talent search. You get the best people together. Who cares? Whoever finds a cure for a certain disease, are we going to say, ooh, I don't know, they don't really fit sort of the profile of what I consider to be someone in a role of this? No, because it's really about talent. And I hope that businesses will emulate that model because that...
Pella Doda doesn't get elected. I'll just say that.
No, and I hope... It's true. I hope that they'll emulate this model.
I'm going out on a limb.
Because you're the one network he doesn't own.
Exactly. But Monique was the chairperson of the committee that I sat on. So we had these long conversations about, do you force women on board? Do you influence, peer pressure, shaming people in realizing that, you have a public company and you have one female director. That doesn't work in this environment of ours. So this debate can go on.
But for me, I don't think it's a board conversation. People always talk about
exactly
boards.
Exactly right.
Because boards are not that important. Honestly, I sit on a lot of boards and, you know.
Not for long. Not for much longer.
No, but... They're not terribly important. For me, it's the C-suite.
It's the management
of organizations. You know,
absolutely.
Because the boards are still a very crony and not terribly productive environment.
And what I find is we have all these committees, and we have our HR people working hard on hiring, and we have these quotas that we want to meet because it's very important. We're a crown corporation, and we'd like to be a leader in there. And we have an environment which is actually... pretty welcoming, let's put it this way, to talent, male or female, and has a lot of flexibility with ours, which might not be the kind of flexibility that you have, for example, in your business. And we're not very good at this, even if we push. So I'm with Bertrand on this. Our numbers, and I'm not sure what you have seen in your organizations, but our numbers are not where they should be. And you're right, we're failing. But it's I don't think it's by pushing women on boards that it works. I think it's about the C-suite. I think it's about an attitude. I think it's an attitude in hiring. I think it's an attitude in where the people around you see the talent and pick the talent. I think the search firms have to be called in when you actually do the profile of the person that you want. You actually can influence the search, clearly, by the criteria that you'll put on that paper. And we do that a lot. I believe in that.
Yeah, and I would say one final thing because I can say it on the woman on this panel that you can't get too obsessed as a woman with this notion that there are a lot of limitations, and so you go through your career feeling that you're always going to have a lesser position everywhere. I think sometimes you do really have to create your own opportunities, however you choose to do that. I am not the person that would have fit the profile to run Brain Canada. I pushed my way in because I had a particular vision, and I fortunately had a few people, several of them men, who were part of that traditional network, who believed in me and supported me, and I worked very hard for that. So I think it's important to balance not undermining the reality of the situation, but also as women to feel empowered that there are opportunities. There are a lot of great women who do amazing things, and you have to really go in life with that mindset and not one of a deficit.
Well, thank you very much for this wonderful insight. So just to bring it to a conclusion. So final words in the future. So, in your opinion, do we have a bright or a dark future ahead of us? And if you could maybe share, what do you think is the biggest barrier and also the biggest hope for health and prosperity? And I'll start with Ines.
I think the biggest barrier for any society is looking inward and not outward. And I think for those of us who've lived in Quebec through the Charter of Values debates and all the other ways that we've sort of created a sense of not only looking inward, but somehow diversity is an issue, or those are societies that become isolated eventually. And so if you want to thrive as a society, as an organization, you really have to embrace looking outward, always, always looking outward, and just finding the best ideas, the best people, the best models. That's how you succeed. I think in terms of hope, to me, I'm really excited about, I look at Julie, and I actually mentor Julie, and there are a lot of young women like her, young MBA students like her, who are really involved in their communities, and they really want to make social change. And that is the most encouraging for me when I see, because in my time doing the MBA, it really was about management consulting or investment banking or something, you know, along those lines. But the idea of pursuing a career where you were actually going to run a social enterprise was not really talked about. And in fact, I did my MBA at the same time as a Master's of Management with the IMPM model because I couldn't get what I needed out of the MBA alone in terms of being around other people who also wanted to lead voluntary organizations. That to me is very hopeful. But I also have met some incredible people in my career, and the thing they all have in common, no matter what they do, is that they find a way to give back to their communities. And I love this quote that I heard Marla Thomas say about her father, that there's two types of people in this world. They're the givers and the takers. And the takers eat better, but the givers sleep better. And I think if you just put a little bit of effort, you know, in sleeping a little bit better. You don't have to run a nonprofit to do that, but you just have to figure out a way that you're going to have a legacy in this world that is going to be bigger than just yourself. And that, I believe, is what is most hopeful, that the young people today are really hopeful and engaged in doing that.
For me, it's funny because I think that the world we live in, on the face of it, looks extremely scary. But I think there are three drivers of fear. The first one is a world that looks geopolitically very complicated and challenging. The second one, most important one, is that our environment represents clearer and present existential threat to mankind. And the third one is the promise of technology, and will technology be a force for good or a force for evil? I'm not, you know, there's a chance, I was reading recently that, you know, if I get to live until, you know, I'm 51 years old, if I get to live till 2045, there's actually a good chance I'm going to live till, you know, 2100. And you know, I don't know if I want that. I don't know if that's fair. I don't know if that's acceptable. I don't know. And so right now, for me, the big exercise that I try to do is, you know, in front of all of that, that's extremely scary. At the same time, you have to look at the facts. Facts, for instance, is Canada is less violent than it's ever been. You know, the number of crimes, violent crimes, keep going down. And it sort of works. We have a democracy that sort of works. We have great institutions like McGill that works. I think that, you know, it's a very difficult time where we have to find a way to, you know, sanity is about the bridge between the macro elements of life and the micro elements of life. And when that gap gets very, very big, it gets very scary. When I finished my undergrad at McGill in 86 in economics, my thesis was about that. I asked my students back then, it was still the Cold War, I would say, you know, what's the future of mankind? And they would tell me, well, the world's going to shit. There's going to be a nuclear holocaust. And then I would ask them a few other questions. And I would ask them, you're graduating in a few weeks. What are you going to do? I'm going to find a job. I'm going to get married. And the disconnect between that, you know, was like, I mean, it was a little bit crazy. And I think that, you know, doing that same exercise today is even more challenging than it's ever been. So we have to somehow find our sanity between these two tensions that are increasingly growing.
Beth, final thoughts?
I think it's a complicated future, Bertrand. And what I hear Ines say. Choices. It's all about choices. It's a complicated future. It's a future that if you're not comfortable in gray, you're going to be very miserable. I think the biggest barrier to going forward is a lack of education. And it's not because I'm sitting in a chair in the management faculty that I believe that. I believe in educating people against the fear of what's going on in the world. I believe in educating people who want to destroy the world, or destroy, or put something on their body and explode themselves in a market somewhere. I believe in education, allowing children to believe in values. So I think that is, in itself, the greatest barrier and the biggest hope, the education piece. I have two little girls. I might be the oldest person by far on this panel, but my children are younger than the children of the people on the panel. So I have a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old.
You're a late bloomer.
Yes, in some ways. But having a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, as you watch what's going on, is really scary. And if you stop at that, then your two little girls are going to be faced with always breaks. And there are going to be breaks in terms of breaks like this, not in a nice break. They're going to be slowed down. They're going to be too careful. So I think you got to believe. And I think education is the key.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. It was a very interesting session. And now I'm going to pass it on to Demetrios for the concluding statement.
Thank you. Really interesting. And very interesting. We have to do something.
I apologize. I'm sorry, the audience. You do have questions. You have two microphones on each side. You have volunteers that will help you. Please try to be mindful of the time and ask one question at a time with a quick follow-up if possible. Thank you.
Get two people at a time.
Hi, I just first wanted to compliment Inej on your comment around the ecosystem. I think that's very, very powerful as we think about running organizations, solving micro problems or macro problems. It's all about understanding what the core is and developing an ecosystem around it, so good comment. My question is to Bertrand. You made a comment around we got to get more efficient and try and recycle, reuse, get faster, get our bang for the buck. In your industry, I'm challenging your comment when I look at advertising and say my audience is grandparents, parents, our generation, kids. How do you recycle, reuse, and especially for the younger generation who listen and discard and want something new tomorrow every day? How do you recycle?
Well, I don't think I referred to recycling. I'm just saying that it's about acceleration because the attention span is so much lower. Because, like, for instance, one of my biggest clients is Facebook, and you know the future of social media and communication is basically a video of approximately 7 seconds. That is the format that we're talking about. So this gentleman here has a whole company that's crafting, you know, 60-minute pieces, and you have a consumer across all generations that wants a 7-second message. So I think that he has to change radically. He has to accelerate. I have to accelerate. I have to produce completely different. I have to generate ideas completely different way. So if I can recycle, that's amazing. I mean, I call it composting. It's a little bit more, you know, but absolutely, but it's hard. I mean, but if you get to work across a lot of categories, and you can do that a little bit because.
Average news clip?
Average, it's interesting that you use 7 seconds. Average quote on a news clip, 6 seconds.
Less than 10 seconds.
Absolutely.
World. So it's amazing that you managed to sit through all this.
Well, I mean, you watched them. I mean, they were texting, they were reading. There's some guys with the iPad in the back, the lady, it's okay.
Second screens. That's what life's all about.
You all come from three very different organizations, and my question's quite open-ended, but just a brief answer. I'd be curious for each of you, if you could narrow it down to one priority. What's the single greatest priority of your organization at this time, and what's the biggest obstacle or what's holding you back? That's my question.
You've been leading us.
The single biggest priority. I have to say it really is around the data question. I think it's going to be massive what we can do with that intersection of brain and technology. Companies are getting involved now. Tech companies are getting involved in brain research in like we've never seen. Not just because of the notion of artificial intelligence, but if you actually can figure out how the brain works as a system, you're going to unlock the ability to make technologies that are more interactive, that are more responsive, that are better. That is going to be the paradigm change that changes everything. So for us, it's what are we going to do with that intersection?
Well for me, I've alluded to it at its speed. And the biggest barrier to speed, unfortunately, I'm going to quote Joseph Stalin. Uncle Joe used to say, when you have people, you have problems. When there's no people, there's no problem. And you know, the thing that stands in the way of speed is unfortunately people and the way they view the world.
Culture shift, people not wanting to embrace this virage, this turn that we need to go much faster at, which is we don't need to do the delivery of our product through television in a linear way. That's gone. Even if 89% of the population still sits, it's behind in a chair, according to a program, 27 hours a week. That's a stat. Speed.
Hi. Okay, I'll go.
Go ahead.
This question is for Hubert, but maybe it's a good segue into the last discussion. I also work for a telco company, and I really loved what you said that that the mobility is not a platform, it's a world. And I totally agree with that, and that we're always on our phones unless we're sleeping. And my question is, seeing that and seeing in telco how you have to be so fast-paced and you have to respond so quickly to the changing environment, which makes it exciting but also very challenging, my question is, when you're in a big organization and you work for a huge corporate company and there's a lot of roadblocks, how do you respond quickly, and how do you become very fast-paced to respond to the evolving environment when you're such a big corporate company?
You got to make some choices. You got to slice the elephant in different pieces. You can't look at CBC Radio Canada as a monolith. I mean, what for example we would do on news gathering? Right now, we went from a $45,000 or $50,000 camera on your shoulder with a sound person and a person for something else carrying the stuff to our reporter in the field working with whatever widget, let's say an iPhone, and delivering quality which is about 86% or 87% of the camera on your shoulder at $45,000. So you're not going to change the whole of the news gathering operation, but you're going to slowly change some pieces of it. And you're going to give your news team an assignment to change its workflow. Because now at a desk, you have the person who is the videographer, who shoots the story, who tells the story, who puts it in the machine, and who makes it available to everybody in the country. That was unheard of. The unionized environment on Radio-Canada's side doesn't allow us to do that yet. This is a battle that you might have been reading about. But, for example, that's one piece of it. We can't have the whole ship do this all the time. We've got to break it up.
Thank you.
I'm a great believer in integrated management. I use it as much as possible, found that it works in project management, it works in operations, where you break down the barriers and all that. And Hubert, you've taken that to an extreme by saying we no longer have any offices in our organization. But there's still an element of business, I call it a strategic element, which I find it's you know, you sometimes you have to keep to yourself for a while. If you're going to do an acquisition, if you're talking about you've had a reduction in sales, you've got to make some changes in structure, you know, layoffs and this sort of thing. How do you do that within an integrated management structure? Because people get scared and then the word starts getting out and you can lose control of the message and all that, or stuff can get out that you don't want to get out. Can you maybe define your experience in that area?
The physical plant, we call them plants, in Halifax, obviously has what we call whisper booths, where you have these conversations. You'll have at the center of the place or on the sides, you'll have conference rooms. So you can actually have these places where confidentiality is key. But the physical geography and the neighborhoods, we call them neighborhoods, of who's working where changes constantly. And we're not the people that actually have pushed this forward. The banks are way ahead of us in a number of places. I visited the BDC and the ABC in Australia. Again, they have moved way beyond this. We're learning from each other. Confidentiality is an issue. I saw La Presse move this week. I was interested in the picture that I saw in La Presse of their new premises. Not visited yet, but I will. I still saw cubicles and I still saw offices in the back. So I'll challenge Guy and what he did there. It'll be interesting. But it's something we learn about in terms of. I'll give you an example. In one of our studios, we're testing this. The studio is in the middle of the station. There are no walls around the studio. So the host brings in Ines and brings in Bertrand, sits them in front of them in the middle of the station. There is a red light. There is no wall between these people and the techies in the back that are running the program. It's completely open. Took about 3 days for the host to actually live with the moving environment as he's interviewing these two. But it makes their interview, from the guest's point of view, really difficult. Because you used to be in a little booth, and you have a relationship one-on-one at radio. Now, all of a sudden, you're in the middle of the world. Well, folks, we are in the middle of the world. So it's interesting to see how that changes, too.
Let me add a piece that is interesting on the science side, because the U.S. has a very individualistic model. In fact, people who even work in the same institution have their doors closed to their labs because they're afraid that somebody's going to get a piece of information. And Canada is quite different, that we've always embraced this collaborative model. It's been much easier to do collaborative science in Canada because scientists will share. And they find that that's why we've excelled in brain research, and we're one of the world leaders, because that's one field where you really do need to have a lot of different people coming together. So even in an area where, you know, it's seen to be highly competitive, the reality is once you start to break down those barriers, you do get to better outcomes. And I see that that's being now embraced. And we have been very lucky. We've had a lot of reviewers for our science projects from the U.S., from Europe. And the reason they do this for us is they say, we could never do this in our countries before. We want to learn how Canada is making this happen, because this is the future of science.
Very good. Thank you.
Do we just have time for one more question?
Okay. Thank you, Julie. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, first off, to our panel speakers. I think you all did an excellent job in blending humor and interesting topics on a Saturday morning. I was really glad, Ines, that you brought up the topic of big data and joint problem solving, and it keeps it being a recurring theme. I believe personally that's the future. But my question, because you mentioned using grants to advance health research, when we look at other business, you know, even aerospace, you know, mobile technology, even consumer products, broadcasting. How can we bring incentives to, you know, the 6 billion joint problem solvers potentially competing for the same business or even the recognition? And when I talk about bringing it to those 6 billion people, not the usual type of candidates, but the everyday person that might have a good idea. How do you think we can bring incentives to them to help joint problem solve?
I think that's more in Bertrand's space, but I can putting you on the spot. But I can tell you in science, the open access platforms have been working really well. The problem is that you have to standardize the language, and then these are not like floppy disks that you can pass around. They have to be housed somewhere, and you have to be able to get people access to them. And that's the challenge right now, to try to get the technology to the point where you can really make the data available in a language that can be used broadly. But, you know, there's that great example, you know, with the Gulf oil spill and a tattoo artist who came up with the idea of how you could extract and contain, because he was doing this when he removed tattoos, and he could apply the same technology to the oil spill when they needed to extract and contain oil. And so you should never be surprised at ideas coming from people who are completely out of your radar. And if you can get to the point where ideas and data are available, it can work. And there are some micro examples, and they're not so micro, but some disease charities now are putting forward a challenge, a prize, $50,000, to come up with a particular technology to help somebody with ALS be able to speak. And they put that out in an open platform, and everybody who has access to the internet can look at this problem and think about a solution. And it can really work. So, you know, in science, it is really exciting. We just have to figure out how to get it to work at an operational level when you've got so much data. But I think in terms of the business model, Bertrand's really the expert in this.
Well for me, the thing that we do increasingly is work on how you compensate people. Compensating on outcome as opposed to effort, I think, is a good way. There are some management theorists now that are pushing that to the extreme, but for us, really rewarding outcomes financially, I think, is a really useful way of driving the behaviors that we want from people, the collaboration.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your questions, and now I'm going to finally open the floor to Dimitrios.
Okay, thank you very much. Julie, great job.
Thank you.
Inez, Hubert, Bertrand, thank you very much. How are you feeling? Good? Yeah, I feel great because I think it was very insightful. It was inspirational as well because I think it was encouraging, was very positive. I like Bertrand's comment about time. I'm not going to quote Uncle Joe, but Einstein said, I cannot think about the future because it comes too soon. I think it's close enough. I like Inez's comment about how science is a great equalizer. I think it's very important. And when I'm thinking about our MBA program, about 50% of our students coming from a science engineering background, so we never had an issue with diversity, and we all know that. But for me, the biggest takeaway is what Hubert said about whether if you want to get inspiration, you go to Morty's office, right? He still has a big enough office, and that's where you're going to find me, and that's why I'm there. So anyway, what's coming up next? First off, I would like you to pull out your phones and download the Desotel app if you haven't done so, because also there's a link to the Uber app, which is going to give you $30 off your first ride. Next is a networking coffee break right outside this door. So please network, get interesting conversations together. That goes on for about half an hour. Afterwards, we have the four parallel sessions going on, so please consult the passports for the content of the interactive workshops. And then those are going to repeat on the other side of lunchtime, which is going to feature, of course, Sugar Sammy. Okay? Anything else to add? We're good? All right. Thank you very much for participating. Thank you to the participants.